So to set my talk in the context, let me remind you the basic milestones of the development and introduction of the standard model. So some history for you. In 64, quark model was proposed with three quarks. This was done to explain many particles that were arising in experiments at the time. The key people involved are Gell-Mann, Zweig. In 67, Weinberg and Salam proposed electroweak SU2U1 theory, to which at the time not many people paid attention. In 73, Fritz and Gell-Mann proposed SU3 gauge theory of strong interactions. The original quark model was just kind of a phenomenological model. There was no SU3 gauge field in it. Also in 73, asymptotic freedom was discovered, and at that, well, this discovery, of course, allowed to take this SU3 gauge theory seriously, and that explained why quarks are not seen at low energies. Incidentally, I realized preparing this colloquium that we are either 50 years, celebrating 50 years of standard model now, or maybe next year, depending on when. One can say that this is how the standard model, this is when it was formulated, but of course it probably took maybe an extra year to put the pieces together and formulate what we now know as a standard model. But in any case, it's either 50 years this year or next year. Another fact I wanted to mention is that almost immediately after the introduction of the standard model, people started thinking beyond the standard model. And of course, the most famous model that was proposed at that time, already at the end of 73, the paper was published in 74, is Georgi Glashow model. The history of discovery of Georgi Glashow model is very interesting. Georgi talks about this in some conference paper that I cite here, but he points out that he came to SU5 starting with Pati Salam, which he reinterpreted. Then he realized that SO10 is relevant, and only after that he realized how SU5 model works. And they wrote paper, famous Georgi Glashow paper on SU5 Gein unification, because they believed that SU5 is a simpler model of Gein unification rather than SO10. But it's interesting that SO10 was discovered very early on, and it helped to discover the more known SU5. Okay, that's the history. Before I even say what the aims of this talk are, let me also say a few things about the current status of grand unification. The minimal SU5 grand unified theory of Georgi Glashow is ruled out experimentally. You probably all know this. It's incompatible with bounds on proton decay. Very early on, it was realized that theoretically, grand unified theories, they have some problems, like couplings don't run and don't quite meet at grand unified energy scale. And this was a motivation for supersymmetric grand unified theories, which kept people excited for many, many years. But now there is less excitement about them. So definitely, I don't talk about anything supersymmetric in this talk. After 50 years of these developments, it's clear that many, many models can be constructed. The type, what goes into the construction is you choose the Higgs field content, and then you choose, the other choice you make is whether the interactions are renormalizable or maybe not. Maybe you allow higher dimension operators. Many different, because there are many different choices for the Higgs, many different models can be written down. These models are quite complicated, in particular because there are several different Higgs fields. One needs to set different Higgs fields will break symmetries at different energies. One needs to analyze it all. It's complicated business doing phenomenology of grand unification. Another problem with grand unification is that many models that are constructed, they simply predict that something happens at very high energies, but nothing interesting happens at low energies, so they're not testable. You see, there is not a unique preferred model, and then these models are not testable. Many of them are not testable. There are, of course, exceptions. And so after 50 years of progress on grand unification, no convincing model arose. That's the current status. There are many models. These models are compatible with phenomenology, but no convincing model exists. And at least this is my impression, but of course I'm not a phenomenologist, that there is also some fatigue in trying to develop models like this. Of course, there is a large phenomenological community, but it's my understanding that this sort of physics is no longer fashionable. And as a result, what was known, the simplest things that were known in 70s, 80s to all of the theoretical particle community, this no longer propagates. Many younger people don't know some simple basic facts. So one of the aims of this colloquium is to explain you very simple things about SL10 unification. Okay, so now the aims. As I said, I want to describe basics of SL10 grand unification, explaining simple facts that everybody should know in as simple terms as possible. And this is not a phenomenology talk. I'm not a phenomenologist. I'm a mathematical physicist, so I can only give a mathematical physics talk. So it's a way to explain SL10 grand unification from the perspective of a mathematical physicist rather than phenomenologist. Factually, there is very little new in my presentation. I'm explaining known facts. Most of what I explained was known, as I said, already to Glashow in 73. The only thing that is new is a point of view, and this point of view is more geometric. And you'll see what that means. So, even though I am not a phenomenologist, and a phenomenologist would know most of the content of this talk from the year one of their PhD, I still believe that phenomenologists would learn something from my presentation, from this change of perspective. So if there are phenomenologists in the audience, it can still be a useful discussion for you. And so, because I'm mostly concentrating on geometry, on geometric aspects, another possible title of this talk is Geometry of SL10 Symmetry Breaking. Okay, you've all seen this picture, right? This is a picture of the particle content of the standard model. We have three generations of fermions, we have gauge fields, and there is a Higgs boson. I will ignore dynamics of gauge fields for purposes of this talk, because I'll concentrate on fermions. Higgs, of course, interacts with fermions, and so I will have to mention Higgs, but this will not be an important thing. And I will only concentrate on the first generation, because I want to explain what happens at the level of one generation. We all know that Dirac fermions, of which we're all made, all elementary particles, we describe them using Dirac fermions, they are Lorentz spinners. It will be clearer what that means on the next slide. The standard model gauge group is SU3, SU2, U1. And every particle transforms in a representation of this gauge group. But the tricky point about standard model is that it's chiral in the sense that left-handed particles and right-handed particles transform under different representations of GSM. And to understand this, I need to describe to you Dirac fermion in more details. These are basics. That this is what we all learn in quantum field theory courses. Of course, to understand what Lorentz spinners are, we need gamma matrices. This is a particular representation of gamma matrices that I like. They're all off-diagonal, and they're constructed from Pauli matrices. So these guys are 4x4. They're constructed from 2x2 blocks, which are basically Pauli matrices. These gamma matrices satisfy the Clifford algebra defining relations. So gamma mu plus the other way around is twice the Minkowski metric. And maybe I can put the identity matrix on the right-hand side. That's implied. So this is it's 4x4 on the left-hand side, so it must be 4x4 on the right-hand side, and it's implied that there is an identity matrix. Now, Dirac spinner is just a column four, four-component column on which these gamma matrices act. This is column with complex valued entries. And it splits naturally, at least, you see, I grouped things into 2x2 blocks. My spinner also naturally groups into two-component blocks. They are called two-component spinners. So this xi and eta tilde are two-component columns with complex entries. Now, we say that the top column is left-handed spinner, left-handed two-component spinner. The right, the bottom column is a right-handed two-component spinner. Of course, there can be explained why this is terminology, but we can also, just for purposes of this talk, accept that this is a definition. It's just terminology. Now, if we have Clifford algebra, then we immediately get spinner representation of our Lorentz group, in particular its Lie algebra. If we have the usual vector representation of Lie algebra by anti-symmetric 4x4 matrices, this A, we can form such an object. Now it's a 4x4 matrix, 4x4 complex matrix, because these guys are complex. And this is Lie algebra isomorphism, or Lie algebra, sorry, homomorphism. So the commutator of these guys is the same as X for the commutator of the matrices. But anyway, we get this is the standard way we see spinner representation of the Lorentz Lie algebra. It's generated by products of different gamma matrices. Okay, I hope this is all familiar. Now, gamma matrices are off-diagonal. So if I make the notation that my left-handed, the top guy, is in S plus, the bottom is in S minus, then gamma matrices map S plus into S minus, left-handed into right-handed, and vice versa. Products of an even number of gamma matrices will preserve the spaces S plus minus, and in particular, Lie algebra preserves S plus minus. So two-component spinners are, we call them, we just define terminology, we call them Weyl spinners to distinguish from four-component Dirac spinners. And Weyl spinners are irreducible representations of the Lorentz group. Four-component spinner is not an irreducible representation. Two-component spinners are. So this must all be very familiar. Maybe slightly less familiar, at least in this way of presenting things, are the notions of inner product. So there is a Lorentz invariant inner product on spinners. It can be restricted to S plus and S minus. And on S plus, it is given explicitly by this formula. In particular, it's anti-symmetric. So the inner product of any spinner with itself is zero. Same on S minus. And there is also an invariant antilinear map. Antilinear means involving complex conjugation. And it maps S plus into S minus. It maps left-handed into right-handed. Explicitly, it is given by this formula. You take complex conjugate two-component spinner, and you multiply by some matrix. It turns out that this map is, it commutes with Lorentz group. So this is why it's an invariantly defined map. It makes sense, and it exists. So left-handed spinners are complex conjugates of right-handed spinners. This is probably a familiar fact, and that's what is encoded here. And this way of explaining things is useful because the notion of inner product and charge conjugation will exist for any Clifford algebra spin group in any dimension of any signature and so on. The analogs of these two things always. By that I mean that you can, of course, do Clifford algebras and related spin groups in any dimension and in any signature. So these maps, these objects have an analog always. Now, let's talk about Weyl-Lagrangian. And because, well, we want to say that every two-component spinner, we must give it some dynamics. These dynamics will be described by Weyl-Lagrangian. So again, Dirac spinner is a pair of Weyl spinners, xi eta tilde. Xi is in S plus, eta tilde is in S minus. And you see, the reason why I called it eta tilde is to distinguish. I wanted tilde to take care of the fact that it's a different type of spinner. It's a spinner in S minus rather than S plus. But now we have the notion of charge conjugation. It's this operation that maps left-handed into right-handed and vice versa. It turns out to be very convenient to parameterize this right-handed spinner here as a charge conjugation of some left-handed spinner. This is always possible, and let's do this. So this will be the way we parameterize things, our Dirac spinners. So then psi and eta are both left-handed spinners. Now, with this parametrization, Dirac-Lagrangian, which is a kinetic term for this spinner, splits as a sum of two kinetic terms for this psi and eta. We just need to specify what the kinetic term for one of them is. And it's this construction. You form a Dirac operator. This Dirac operator maps S plus into S minus. And then you take inner product with a charge conjugation of psi. This charge conjugation of psi is an S minus. This is also an S minus. You pair, you integrate over space-time. You put a factor of I in front to make it real. So this is the Weyl Lagrangian. And as I said, Dirac Lagrangian is just a sum of such two things. And then if this spinner transforms in some representation of some gauge group, to take care of this, you just add a connection to your Dirac operator. And then, well, now this is also gauge invariant. You can transform the psi locally. You can do a gauge transformation on the spinner and transform the connection at the same time. The Lagrangian is gauge invariant. So this is the way Weyl fermions couple to connections. And having understood this, we can ignore this from now on. So the reason why I explained all this is that I want to parameterize. I wanted to explain that now I parameterize all the spinners that I have by left-handed spinners. It is this idea that right-handed guys are just basically complex conjugate of left-handed. So I can use left-handed always. This is convenient because then I don't need to say which is what. I only use left-handed. And then dynamics of any left-handed spinner is something like this. And then we can ignore this the rest of the talk will be understanding how this psi, what type of representations of gauge group arise and why they arise. But it's important to understand that every psi that we have in nature is described by a Lagrangian of this sort. Okay, now particles of the standard model. I want to describe just one generation of the standard model because every other generation does the same thing. At least in the kinetic terms, in the Lagrangian, there is some more complicated story in the what is called Yukawa terms. But kinetic terms do behave very simply. So as I said, we use only left-handed spinners to parameterize all particles. And now to specify kinetic terms for all the fermions, I just need to specify what gauge group there is. And this is SU3, SU2, V1. And I need to tell you what are the representations that appear in nature. Well, this is a complicated table here. U and D, they're quarks. And the fact that they're quarks is related to the fact that they transform non-trivially under the strong SU3. They also transform non-trivially under the weak SU2. Then, and they came from left particles. This is the left particles that transform, that interact non-trivially with weak SU2. This U and D bar, they used to be right-handed particles, but we parameterize them as charge conjugation of left-handed ones for convenience. They do not interact with SU2. They are singlets SU2, but they are still, they still interact strongly. This is an anti-triplet of SU3. And then, so these are all quarks, and leptons are, again, we have a pair of leptons which interacts with SU2, which is a doublet. And then E-bar, which is a singlet. It's the right-handed electron, so to say, or maybe positron. Is described by these two component spinner. Another remark is that in this table, these bars are no longer complex conjugation, they're just part of the name of the particles. an interesting exercise is to count how many particles there is. This is 2 times 3, because they're triplets, so there is 6 here, and there is 6 more there. This is 12, and there is 3 more there. So there are 15 two-component spinners that we need to describe one generation of fermions. So 15 particles here. Another remark is that this table is difficult to remember. I don't think, unless you're a phenomenologist and you work, you see it every day, you would remember this table. I don't. And every time I need to check something, I need to look it up, so I don't remember this table. And maybe this is one of the punchlines of the talk, is that if you know how this comes from SO10, you can derive this table just by remembering like one entry from this table, for example, just by remembering that Y charge of neutrino and electron is -1/2. By remembering that, you can derive everything else just by knowing that it comes from spin 10. That's beautiful, and I'm going to explain how this comes out.
Are you going to mention Y and T3?
Well, T3 is this SU2. This is part of electroweak symmetry breaking here, right? So there is a T3, which is +1/2 and -1/2. For everything that is SU2 doublet, this guy has T3 1/2. The bottom one has -1/2. And then we know that electric charge, the one that is observed, is the sum, right? Okay. The next step is we want to understand how these 15 particles fit into a 16-dimensional complex representation of the group called spin-10 or SO10. So we need to understand spinner representations, in particular in 10 dimensions. So the statement is that this 15 fits into 16 spinorial representation. We need to understand spinners in higher dimensions, or in 10 dimensions. And there are some basic facts.
And you mean 10 Euclidean dimensions?
These are 10 Euclidean dimensions, yeah. These are 10 internal dimensions now. So we need Clifford algebra in 10 dimensions. Of course, Clifford algebras are algebras generated by higher D analogs of gamma matrices. So we'll have 10 gamma matrices. Spinners are columns on which gamma matrices act. Definition of Clifford algebra is that, well, it's a vector space with a metric, and Clifford algebra for that vector space is algebra generated by vectors subject to this relation, but at the more pedestrian level, these are just gamma matrices that satisfy Clifford algebra defining relation. Clifford algebra as a vector space is spanned by products of all possible gamma matrices and has dimension 2 power n. Another basic fact about Clifford algebras is that in any signature, in any dimension, Clifford algebras are just matrix algebras of R, C, and H. And there is a complicated table that explains in what dimension you get what. But this fact is not going to be important for purposes of my talk, but it's good for general knowledge to know that Clifford algebras are just matrix algebras, always. So spinners are those columns on which these matrices act, or irreducible representations of Clifford. And maybe it's also good to state the definition of the spin group. This is a spin group generated by products of an even number of Clifford elements of squared norm 1. And Clifford group, spin group is a double cover of the special orthogonal group. Now, for purposes of this talk, I want to give a very concrete description of spinners, in particular of spin 10. There will be a very simple model that you can remember and use. But to explain this model, yes?
Could you go back to the previous thing you said about the spin group? Even products.
Even number of Clifford.
Like 4 of them?
You can have 4 of them.
Indexed.
Well, but remember, I'm talking about a spin group rather than Lie algebra of spin. So Lie algebra is generated by 2 gamma matrices. But now it's a non-trivial statement that spin group itself is generated by products of even number. You multiply, you take a vector, you realize it as an element of Clifford algebra, and you conjugate it by products of an even number of Clifford elements of norm one, and that turns out to be the spin group. Or, well, that's a definition of spin group, but what is non-trivial is that it double covers the orthogonal group. This is a very useful statement because this describes the group, and you can actually use this to prove how the group acts, because it gives a complete description of the spin group. Okay, so I want explicit model for spin to n. And in the literature on grand unification, in particular literature on spin 10, the model that people used for a long time, and probably this is still the most used description, they construct gamma matrices of larger spin by products of 2x2 matrices, tensor product of 2x2 matrices. That's a very difficult model to use, at least in my opinion. I think it's difficult, confusing, and probably one needs even, or one develops intuition working with such things and then can do it in the head, or one uses a computer. I don't know. It seems difficult for me to define things like that. So what I'm presenting for you is a much simpler model. This model arises if one chooses a complex structure on R to N. By choosing the complex structure, we'll see that in a second. I'll state the fact that what commutes with the complex structure, the subgroup, the orthogonal transformations that commute with complex structure are un, and then the model that to describe arises by restricting spin representation to un subgroup. And then, but let me remind you what complex structures are. Orthogonal complex structure in R to n is a map that squares to minus one and is compatible with the metric in this way. So well, the simplest example is a complex structure in two dimensions. This is the one that just rotates xy plane by 90 degrees. And this is the one. The basic fact about complex structures is that they split the space they act on into eigenspaces. J squares to minus identity. It has eigenvalues plus I minus I, and it splits your vector space into two copies of Cn. R to n becomes identified, if you want, with Cn. Well, this is this formula. R to n becomes Cn plus the complex conjugate of Cn. The meaning of this is that every real vector, you can write it as an eigenvector, as a complex eigenvector of J, plus its complex conjugate. And an example, the simplest example, is in R2 again. You see here in this formula, I wrote real vector xy as an eigenvector of J of eigenvalue plus I and its complex conjugate. So this is what complex structures do for you. They allow you to represent your real vector in R2n as a complex vector in Cn. Well, they provide identification between R2n and Cn. But this identification is extra structure you need to put in. Okay, so now the basic statement about complex structures is that subgroup of GL2nR that commutes with a fixed complex structure is GLnC, and similarly subgroup of SO2nR that commutes with a fixed orthogonal complex structure is UN. So rephrasing it, well, one way to rephrase it is that choice of UN subgroup inside SO2N is a choice of orthogonal complex structure, or the choice of identification of R2N with CN. So imagine we make such a choice. If this is a bit too confusing for you, ignore it. You just identify R2N with Cn in some way you like. Let's make it pedestrian. So after we make this identification, what preserves this identification, the subgroup of SO2N that preserves this identification, is just the unitary group in n dimensions. Now, and it is a fundamental fact about spinners, and this is where the model will come from. Well, the slight technical thing is that UN is also subgroup of a spin group, but let's ignore it. And then the important fact is that if you restrict the spinner representation to UN, of course, if you restrict any representation to some subgroup, you will start seeing representations of this group. And the fact is that the representations of UN that you see here are just all anti-symmetric complex tensors in n dimensions. Remember, UN naturally acts on CN. CN is just n-dimensional complex column. UN naturally acts by transformations on this n-dimensional column. And then this can be called lambda 1. N-dimensional column is just lambda 1. It's a tensor of rank 1. It's a vector. And then one can consider all anti-symmetric. So rank 2 tensors, rank 3, and so on. And you need all of them. And the statement is that this is your spinner representation. This fact, well, one can say it's a mathematical fact, it's a fact of representation theory, but this is the basis of the model, which I'll describe in a second. So my idea will be I'll choose a complex structure, therefore I'll restrict to UN, and I will describe spinners as these anti-symmetric tensors, or in other words, differential forms. Okay, spinners very concretely. So, as I said, once we restrict spinner representation to UN, a general Dirac spinner, or the general spinner in n dimensions, is an object like this. It can be described as a collection of all possible anti-symmetric tensors, or as a collection of all possible differential forms. This is a zero form, so just a complex number. One form, the dimension of this space is n complex. And then you get you get higher order differential forms. Here my dz is just a label. At this stage there is no manifold. This is just yes. Yes.
Yes, there's no metric on this space.
No, there is no metric on the space. No, it's just a vector space. Yeah, there is no metric. In fact, this space, so the space Cn is totally null with respect to. The space Cn arises as eigenspace of J of the complex structure of, say, eigenvalue plus I, and it's a totally null space. So these Zs are just complex coordinates. I identified R to n with Cn. These Zs are complex coordinates. They're x plus iy, and they're totally null. From the point of view of the metric you had in the big space, this is a totally null space. So there is no metric here.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's very beautiful construction. It's maybe I should say that this construction is not so often used in physics, mathematical physics, theoretical physics literature, even though this is changing. But this is completely standard construction for mathematicians. This is the way they think about spinners.
So
yes?
Is this spin 2n the double cover of
SO? Yeah, double cover. Yeah.
Four dimensions.
Yeah.
But then,
except that there is one subtlety here. I'm doing Euclidean,
right?
But of course, I can also do. I can describe Lorentz group spinners in the same way. Yes.
I'm just wondering about the global equivalence of these anti-symmetric tensors.
Was that's
if you rotate by 360.
That's a good question.
The sign should flip for a spinner, but it won't for this.
There is a subtlety there. I agree. Yeah. Well, will you allow me not to discuss this subtlety? Or will you trust me that
for now?
Okay.
Like it's a touchy point that we should hear about later.
Well,
is it not relevant for what you're saying?
It's not relevant for what I'm saying, no, because it's just a sign of some sort. But your question is whether it's possible to make consistent choice of signs here. Well, this is related to this point. I say that UN is also subgroup. It can be lifted to spin 2N. So I'm saying that there is a consistent way of doing this. But of course, it's such a technical point that I'm unable to explain it now. I'm just making, you should trust me that it works. If you don't trust me, well, I took this this particular formula from a presentation by Michael Attia, and you should trust Michael, yes?
Well, how old is he when he gave the presentation?
okay, well, no, not so old. Anyway, concrete model for our Clifford algebra. So this is our spinner. And dimension of this spinner is 2 to the power n. Remember that now n is half the dimension. So if we are in R10, R10 is 10 is 2 times 5, so n is now 5. Now, a very concrete model of gamma matrices or gamma operators is this one. I introduce creation annihilation operators. I introduce the guys that add basic one forms and that remove basic one forms from my differential form. They will satisfy fermionic creation annihilation operator algebra. This is easy to check. Now I define the appropriate linear combinations. Sum and difference, but the difference must have a factor of an I in front. This factor of I is needed so that these gamma I's, they square to plus 1 rather than minus 1. If I do this, this is my Clifford algebra. I claim that just because of this anti-commutation relations, the gamma matrices is defined this way. They satisfy the defining relations of the Clifford algebra. So this is my Clifford algebra. This is my space of spinners. I have the spin group, and I have everything. This is a concrete model. Some more basic facts about this model. Well, differential forms come in even and odd degree. And my spin group will preserve this division into even odd degree differential forms. The even will be called S plus type spinners. They will be Weyl spinners, odd S minus Weyl spinners. And so we can say that in even dimensions, there is a notion of chirality, and spinners are of two chiralities, and spin group preserves the chirality. This model is also very nice. I don't think I have time to explain all this, but in this model, there is a concrete expression for the inner product on spinners. Again, this is some computation with differential forms. You can read it here. And there is a concrete expression for the charge conjugation operation, completely explicit. Both are given to you in this model. And as I said, it's just there in any dimension. This is the power of the model. But then in spin 10, let's apply this to spin 10. So the statement is that particles of one generation can be fit into a single Weyl spinner of spin 10. Now, let's use our knowledge of, let's use this model of spin 10 that I described. First of all, we'll be fitting into Weyl spinners of spin 10. Remember that, the general Dirac spinner will have dimension 2 power n, so 2 power 5, 32, but it will split into two Weyls of dimension 16 each. And we want to fit 15 of the standard model into 16-dimensional Weyl representation. So let's choose odd degree differential forms. It doesn't matter, I could choose even, but it will be slightly easier to see how the fitting happens into odd degree differential forms. So it's lambda 1, lambda 3, and lambda 5. Dimension of space lambda 1 is the same as dimension of C5 itself. It's just vectors, so 5 dimension. Lambda 3 in 5 dimensions is the same as lambda 2. So it's dimension 10, and this is one dimensional. This is a top form, so this is 16. Now we'll put standard model particles in these two spaces, and one, of course, one is where the right-handed neutrino will live, because SO10, the standard model particles of which there is 15, you put them into 16-dimensional representation. The one remaining is the right-handed neutrino. Okay, first of all, a U5 preserves these decomposition.
Yes. I don't lose track of your logic. You okay. Said the right-handed neutrino. Which one? I mean, well, as I understand it, people have hypothesized it might be a right-handed neutrino, but.
No, I'm just making some mathematical statement. I'm saying that this is 16-dimensional representation. So if you put 15 particles of standard model in it, one is left. It predicts one more particle. Spin 10 unification predicts one more particle that is not part of the standard model. And then this particle, we'll see that it's, just from the point of view of representation theory, singlet with respect to the standard model gauge group. Well, that's what we usually call right-handed neutrino.
It's only one generation, so maybe it's a coctronic neutrino. This is the first generation.
Are you talking about generations? No, you're not talking about this. You're talking about,
yeah.
So I think you have some.
You're describing for us a construction of the standard model.
Yeah.
Beyond the standard model.
It's beyond the standard model. Spin 10 is beyond the standard model because there is one more particle, yes. Or it naturally predicts.
Is it not excluded by, does the model say anything about the mass of that exponent?
No, of course, no. The model is at the level of representation theory. It just tells you what charges of particles will arise. It's not a dynamical model. It's just representation theory description. If that is clear. So the game I'm playing now, I want to explain this table here. And the way I'll explain this table, I'll take a spinner, 16-dimensional spinner representation of spin 10. I will select a standard model gauge group inside spin 10, and I'll see what representations arise. And it will be this list. But this is an interesting calculation. This is a calculation that I want all of us to do this together. Okay, so this is my this is my 16-dimensional vial spin of spin 10. U5, which I selected inside spin 10 to even write this stuff. Because remember, to even write my model of spinners, I needed to choose U5, which I have done. This U5 will preserve this decomposition, so it will not mix particles. Of course, spin 10 does mix this stuff, but U5 doesn't. And maybe another remark is that the subgroup of this U5 that preserves this vector in lambda 5 C5, that the subgroup that preserves the top degree form is SU5. That is standard, it's the same fact that the subgroup of GLN that preserves a top form is SLN. I'm saying the same thing here. It's the subgroup of U5 that preserves the top form is S. The determinant condition is imposed. Another way to say it is that this is where Georgi Glashow unification is, or at least this is the way to see Georgi Glashow SU5 arise from spin 10. One needs to select, one needs to take a Higgs field in this 16-dimensional representation of spin group, 16 Higgs, and make it point in this direction, in the field space. Then what preserves this Higgs field is SU5. That's the way to see how SU5 sits inside spin 10. Okay, there is some more beautiful mass that is related, but I don't have time to explain it. And now this is the main point of the presentation. I want to explain you further how you see. So far, I just explained to you how SU5 sits inside spin 10. Now I want to explain how standard model gauge group is inside. So the key observation is that to see standard model gauge group inside spin 10, you first need to see your SU5, Georgi Glashow, which I said is the same as identifying R10 with C5. But then you need to choose a split of C5 into C3 and C2. It is this split that is the key point of how the standard model gauge group arises, because standard model gauge group is just the subgroup of SU5 that preserves a split like this. And that is easy to see. Indeed, SU5 acts on 5-component columns by usual unitary transformations. If we want C2 and C3 parts of this cone to be preserved, well, we must restrict our attention to matrices of this type. You have 3x3 special unitary block and some phase, 2x2 special unitary block and some phase, and these phases must be consistent so that the determinant of the whole thing is 1. So this is a subgroup of SU5 that preserves the split, and the subgroup is exactly SU3, SU2, U1, in the sense that, well, this is a group homomorphism. You take an arbitrary element of SU3, SU2, U1, and this is the way you put it inside SU5. So, well, this equation is important because this is the way to remember how a standard model gauge group sits inside spin 10, but also SU5. This is exactly what will happen for the Georgi-Glashow unification. That's the embedding of the standard model gauge group inside SU5. And now, having fixed this embedding, so, and as I said, this embedding is the same as having chosen a split, one can do a calculation and predict all the particles. So, already at this stage, maybe I should explain why I put, in principle, the determinant condition is satisfied. I can put any number, I can rescale phi by any integer in particular, and the determinant condition is satisfied. The way I put this fractional, why the power is fractional, is that the determinant condition is satisfied, and my quarks, things transforming on the SU3, they have fractional charges of multiples of 1 over 3, which is correct, and leptons have multiples of 1 over 2 charges, which is also correct. So this is the correct identification. And then we start trying to match particle content with representations here. So let's do the first stage of the matching. Let's take lambda 1 C5 and see what are the charges arising there. So lambda C5 is, of course, just C3 plus C2. C3 is a doublet. Oh, sorry. C2 is a SU2 doublet, which is not transforming on the SU3. The only particle in the list, the only collection of particles in the list, these are clearly leptons. Leptons are, they transform on the SU2, but do not transform on the SU3. So we can only identify this factor with L. Hypercharge of L is minus a half. Then if we look at this particle here, it is triplet with respect to SU3, but doesn't transform on the SU2. And it has charge, Y charge, by looking here. If this is minus half, then it will be 1 over 3 for this particle. So it must be identified with the down quark right-handed guy. So the exercise here is that you fix the embedding, and then you look at what are the charges appearing as irreducible representations, and then you try to match them with the particles you know, and that's the only possible matching. The only subtlety here is that D bar in my table, it was anti-triplet. You see, it was anti-triplet, so I need to say that, in fact, I identify here not with C5, but with C5 bar. So I must be working with C5 bar, the complex conjugate representation, but that's, it's a subtlety that can be ignored. So anyway, at this level, at the level, C5 part splits into D bar and L. And then it's a simple exercise. I'm not sure now I have time to do it for you, but it's shown here. You look at lambda 3, C3 bar plus C2 bar. You compute this third antisymmetric power of this. It's like computing A plus B cubed. So what arises is A cubed plus A squared B plus AB squared. And you compute the arising Y charges. And well, yeah, it all matches the table that one had. I don't think I can explain it in the way people will understand, but it's a very simple exercise. You can do it for yourself. In fact, it's written. You don't need to know more than what is written here. It's just that I cannot trace every step of this calculation. And so at the end of the day, this lambda odd, namely odd degree differential forms in C5, they split into a collection of particles, irreducible representations of standard model gauge group, and they are the particles that we have in our table.
In yes? I'm a little confused about the role of the lambda, like the degrees of freedom in the lambda.
Lambda is just a notation for anti-symmetric tensor product. So lambda 2 is an anti-symmetric matrix.
Right, but...
lambda means differential forms. It's just a notation for differential forms.
Okay, so lambda 1 C5 is just like a...
It's just C5.
...complex.
Lambda 1 C5 is C5, yes. So
five complex.
Yes. Lambda 2 C5 is a 5x5 anti-symmetric matrix.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now some comments about this. All this representation theory was of course known 50 years ago. It was known to Georgi, to Howard Georgi in particular. But at that time he was not clearly, well, I don't think he was thinking in terms of this model of the spin group. People at the time, they were using weights and roots. Weights and roots give you very powerful description of an arbitrary representation of a simple Lie group or simple Lie algebra. But this is a much more complicated way of describing things in the sense that one needs to know many more, there are many more preparatory steps. One needs to understand what that is. What I described to you is completely elementary, and you can repeat the calculation very quickly. You don't need to know anything to repeat the calculation that I've done. While roots and weights, you need to know quite a lot. Another comment is that, so I explained to you how to derive the table of charges of particles of the standard model with very minimal assumptions. The only thing you need to know is that it fits into spin representation of spin 10, and you also need to know the Y charge of leptons, which is not hard to remember because it must be minus a half, because this minus a half plus minus a half must give you 0 and -1. So if you remember that electric charge of an electron is -1, then you would remember that this is minus a half, and this is the only thing you need to know to derive everything else here. So it's with very minimal things to remember, you can obtain the particle content of the standard model, which is amazing. So of course, when this was first seen by Howard Georgi, I'm sure it was mind-blowing to see that what one sees in nature is predicted by mathematics. This is still mind-blowing even 50 years after that. It's very, very simple fact that some representation theory just predicts the charges of the particles, of course, with some assumptions. The assumption is that you select how standard model gauge group sits inside spin 10. That's the assumption. Okay. And then remember, again, what went into our choice of how standard model gauge group sits inside spin 10. This was first choice of SU5, or identification R10 with C5, plus maybe the top form in C5, as well as the choice of this split C3 plus C2. And so these are the two facts that need to be, by any concrete model, that by any concrete grand unified theory model, these two facts must somehow be embedded in the model. You need to put appropriate Higgs fields, which will give you these two facts. The usual grand unified theory models work. One chooses 16-dimensional fermionic, the Weyl spin representation to affect this type of symmetry breaking. And that's the only way to start seeing SU5. Well, maybe not the only one, is maybe too strong. Definitely, this is the minimal dimension of the representation that does it for you. And then one usually chooses a joint representation for the second step. Then one would write, one chooses Higgs fields, one would write general potential for these Higgs fields, and one would hope that minimizing these potentials exactly selects for you this configuration. And even this is, no, it's non-trivial to show that Higgs potentials can do this, because this breaking must be aligned. And this is a non-trivial to achieve by potential. And then usually the model that one finishes the model by saying that standard model Higgs resides in a 10-dimensional vector representation. But this minimal model is not phenomenologically viable. One needs to either add more or different Higgs representations or add higher dimensional operators. So this is why the minimal model is not phenomenologically good. And this is one reason why there is no universally agreed model of Gaunt unification. But of course, one can produce a phenomenologically consistent model just by doing more things and writing more complicated. And I don't know how much time do I have now.
Well, you're getting to the end. So
I'm getting to the end. So I don't think I will be able to explain the new observation, but at least I can advertise. So far what I explained was completely known stuff. Maybe I presented from an unusual point of view, but the new observation, and this was explained in a recent paper of mine, is that the choice of this split C5 into C3 plus C2, which is essential to see the standard model gauge Cooperizing, it can be encoded into second complex structure on R10 that commutes with the first one. Remember, we do need to choose the first one to select an SU5 subgroup of spin-10, and then we need this split. So what I'm saying is that rather than encoding this split some more complicated way, this can be done by choosing a second complex structure which commutes with the first. And, well, there is some mathematics associated to this, which I don't have time to explain. But at the end of the day, complex structure plus this C5 split into C3 plus C2 is nothing else but two commuting complex structures with some subtlety, which I don't have time to explain. And then again, I'm afraid this slide, well, maybe let me at least state the main theorem. The statement is that standard model gauge group is a subgroup of spin-10 that is the intersection of SU5 that fixes the complex structure J and its holomorphic top form, and another U5 that fixes commuting with it complex structure such that the resulting split of is of this type, C3 plus C2. In the paper, I explain it even at yet a different level. I use spinners to affect all these stages of symmetry breaking, but I don't have time to explain this. Okay, again, I must keep it. So my summary is that standard model was proposed exactly 50 years ago, and almost immediately all Gaunt unified theories were proposed. Spin-10 Gaunt unification provides ultimate unification, where both forces and particles of one generation are unified. It also predicts the right-handed neutrino as this extra particle in the multiplet of dimension 16 that is not part of the standard model. There is no yet a convincing concrete spin-10 Gaunt unified theory, but the representation theory definitely provides organizing principle for particles. In particular, we can derive the particle content of standard model from the knowledge of the fact that it all fits into spin-10. The thing to remember, maybe this is the message of the talk, the thing to remember is that if you want to do this exercise and derive table of particles, what you need to choose is SU5 or complex structure. You need to identify R10 with C5, and then split C5 into C3 plus C2, and then all particles come out. Well, the outlook is just repetition of what I didn't really have time to explain, but it seems to me that the best way to think about symmetry breaking is in terms of two commuting complex structures. One sees the standard model gauge group arising from this way. And, well, where it all points to, and that will be the last statement, I promise, complex structures are parameterized by spinners. And so I'm advocating that there is some other grand unified, some other spin Tangut model, which hasn't been considered yet, but I'm advocating that it must be constructed, which has only Higgs fields in the 16-dimensional while representation of spin 10. Because just with such fields, one can affect the right pattern of symmetry breaking. And on this, I'll stop.
Beautiful, beautiful talk. I have a question and then just a historical comment. The question is there a way in which how the spin would fit into still higher dimensional unifications for including gravity is relevant to this?
Well, the only comment in that direction that I can make is that, so of course, what I talked about here was the usual grand unification. It's a unification where you live in four dimensions and then you add, well, you have some gauge group living at every point and then particles are representations of that gauge group. Of course, one can say that maybe this spin 10 in fact tells you that there is 10-dimensional internal space. So one can say that maybe all this is in the direction of Kaluza-Klein. And the only comment in that direction that I can make is that indeed if one takes spinners of spin 10 and remembers that they are also spinners of Lorentz group, then all this collection of spinners can be unified into one big spinner representation of Lorentz group in 14 dimensions. So you can put together 10 with 4, consider orthogonal group there, consider a spinner, and then if you restrict to spin 10 and spin 4, you will start seeing exactly the right particles appearing. That's the only comment I have in that direction.
Okay, great, thank you.
Can you explain this term, symmetry breaking, in terms of commuting complex structures from some known examples? For example, in condensed matter physics, we have lots of symmetry breaking.
Well, here I'm just saying.
Example two.
Yeah, I'm just saying something very simple. If you choose a complex structure in R2n, you break SO2n to UN. If you choose another complex structure, you will further break things. Of course, you need to choose them commuting because you don't want to break too much. You want still something to survive. If you choose two commuting complex structures, which is basically like choosing two different U5s, and two different U5s for the complex structures that commute can intersect only in some ways. And in particular, I'm saying that the standard model gauge group can be seen as intersection of SU5 and U5.
So what other way could it break the C5? Could it go to C1 and C4?
Of course, yeah, it can, yeah. Yeah. Well, this was the slides that I didn't have time to explain. There are just two ways to break. Well, what I know is how to encode, how to require that it is this type of breaking in terms of spinners. There are some. I understand what it means, the level of spinners, in the sense that I can write a potential whose minimum is this particular pattern of symmetry breaking. But this other pattern, in principle, is also possible. And the only comment that I have in that direction is that it seems that when one has both of them, one breaks a standard model gauge group down to the unbroken in nature, so SU3U1. Because having them both means splitting C3, C1, C1, which is what we see in nature. So maybe it's even not wrong, or maybe even both patterns of splitting C, maybe they're both relevant. And maybe one can write a model here. I'm just speculating, but maybe one can write a model which just has 16-dimensional Higgs representations, and model will break all the symmetries down to the one seen in nature.
So you're thinking of it as a rigid algebraic object in the theory, these complex structures, right? Like they would just be specified by God and...
No. They are dynamical. Complex structure is described by this 16-dimensional Higgs field.
Would be a dynamical field.
Of course, yeah. It's just 16-dimensional Higgs field of a special algebraic type is the same as a complex structure.
16-dimensional. So spinner.
Spinner 16-dimensional of spin 10. Yeah. So 16 Higgs in the 16-dimensional representation. If you require that this Higgs is of a special algebraic type, if you like minimize the potential for it,
I see.
That Higgs field is just a complex structure. Uh-huh. Well, plus maybe top holomorphic form, but it parametrizes complex structure. So I'm thinking of several Higgs fields, several complex structures, some potential for them, minimizing the potential.
Is there some other reason why a pure spinner is a natural kind of field to have in the theory?
Well, nature seems to tell us that definitely we need to have one spinner Higgs field. Namely, you see, to see this...
I'm thinking a priori.
No, I don't know. Okay. What I'm saying is that a pattern of symmetry breaking tells us that we need to go... SU5 is part of the pattern of symmetry breaking, as I explained. What I'm saying is that every other symmetry breaking that you need to do can also be done with these SU5s. So the only thing that you need is a collection of SU5s or U5s that intersect appropriately, and then you can break down to what you need, which is unusual. So at least these models of model with this type of Higgs fields have not been tried.
Can I ask a question, John Moffat?
Go for it, John.
So, in the SO10 there's a heavy boson, the X boson, which allows the protons to decay. So the question is, as you pointed out, SU5 is ruled out. The lifetime proton is now 10^4, 10^35. Yes.
So your voice is not very clear. I didn't hear the question.
What is the situation with proton decay?
Well, you're asking phenomenological question. I cannot answer any phenomenological questions. I don't even have a model that I can write down. This is some representation theory, which I explained. It's just representation theory. Whether there is a good model that is compatible or that realizes this representation theory ideas, I don't know.
There certainly are SO10 models that have the unification at high enough energies that they're compatible with proton decay.
Ah, that was the question. Of course, yeah. There are spin-10 good models which are compatible with all the phenomenology. Yes.
Can I ask a question? So you have these two complex structures, and you take them to commute. Now, yep. Obviously, if they were two anti-commuting complex structures,
you would get what?
Is it crucial that they?
Yeah, it's crucial that they commute, because what the two commuting complex structures give you is what is known as product structure, and this product structure is just this split. So of course, it's essential that they commute. Basically, the split comes from the fact that you take one of these, this is eigenspace of one of them, but then because they commute, it must also, the other one will, well, the eigenspace of one will be split into eigenvectors of the other. And this is, let's say, plus I part of the other, this is minus I part of the other. This is why you get this.
You probably can't have.
You can.
Anti-commuting ones unless the dimension is multiple four.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
I have a question. I don't know anything about what I'm going to say except for the lead in to the question. So it might be pill form, but I've heard that anomaly cancellation restricts the charges that could have been assigned in the standard model. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much it restricts it.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, you know, how many possibilities are there that fit anomaly cancellation? And is somehow your construction, by its very nature, guaranteeing that the anomaly would be canceled just by its algebraic structure?
I think spin 10, whatever you can put in spin 10, automatically guarantees that anomaly will be canceled.
I see. So, but there's more than one possibility that you could put in spin 10.
Well, you can consider, imagine taking, well, I don't know, some other complex representation of spin 10, right? And then restricting spin 10 to standard model, and then you'll have some collection of particles. I think spin 10 workings guarantee that this.
So let's say you just talked about C3 plus C2 split versus C1 plus C4.
Yeah.
Could nature have chosen C1 plus C4?
That's not related to anomaly. In both cases, you will get a collection of particles compatible with anomaly cancellation.
Pardon?
If you are. So you're saying let's try to run the scenario where we instead split C4 plus C1. You will get, first of all, the gauge group that will arise here is not the standard model gauge group. It will be SU4.
Right. I'm just asking, would that have been a consistent world?
But it will be a consistent world. Anomaly will be canceled there. Yes.
Basically, once you have a theory that's embedded in SO10 and an anomaly, the SO10 theories will almost always be anomaly free. Because usually anomalies come from U1 gauge groups. So anyway, so then the theory he's describing is anomaly free. So then no matter how you break it, break the symmetry, that doesn't affect. If it's symmetry breaking doesn't affect the anomaly cancellation.
But it's a good question, yes.
Mm. As an interesting aside, there's a famous paper by Ramon from about 20 years ago that points out that if you take the standard this complicated standard model table that he wrote, you take these 15 particles and you give them the known SU3 charges and the known SU2 charges. So you take his SU3 and SU2 charges that Carol wrote, and now you say the hypercharges are unknown. And you ask how much are they fixed by anomaly cancellation. It turns out they are uniquely fixed, almost. There's two solutions, one of which is the one we see in nature, and the other one is not. Okay. Well, I think we're in due of time, and since maybe there are no more questions that I see, let's thank Carol one more time for our interview.